Lawmakers are on day 92 of the legislative session with no budget agreement yet in sight. There are deep philosophical differences among House and Senate members about how to live within the state's budgetary means. Some call for continued cuts to spending, while others say new taxes are needed. How will they reach consensus, and what will the final plan mean for fiscal stability and impacts to citizens? We're back to the budget today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The House passed an income tax plan over the weekend, but the Senate doesn't like it. Neither did some House members. Does the divide over spending, taxes, budget trimming, and service reduction come down primarily to party lines? If that's the case, how can progress toward a sustainable budget be achieved? Here to discuss and describe the various ideas are Institute of Social and Economic Research economist Mohsin Gutabi. Hello.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us in the studio in Anchorage is Commonwealth North past president and former state and municipality of Anchorage OMB director Cheryl Frasca. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
On the line from Juneau to sort of set the scene for our discussion is Alaska Public Media and KTOO's state government reporter, Andrew Kitchenman. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks so much for coming on with us. I know things are really busy down there, and I appreciate your time. You were just at the House Majority Press Conference. What did lawmakers have to say?
The House leadership, this is Speaker Bryce Edgman, Majority Leader Chris Tuck, the House Finance co-chairs and rules chair Gabrielle Ledoux. They basically said that they've passed a comprehensive, sustainable fiscal plan that includes various components, including a draw on the permanent fund, a reduction in PFDs, an income tax, and changes to the oil and gas tax system. And they say they've now sent that over to the Senate, and it's up to the Senate to basically agree to a comprehensive fiscal solution. And then once the Senate agrees to that, then they can negotiate the details of it. But they're basically saying that if one side wants a comprehensive solution and the other side doesn't, then it doesn't sound like they see a lot of room for negotiation. So it was a fairly confrontational press conference in that sense.
And what about what would this mean for the operating budget for next year?
Well, yeah. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. And once there's a conference committee where there's three members from each house who get together to work out, essentially negotiate a compromise over the operating budget, then I think we're going to see a lot of the broader negotiations about everything start going. But that hasn't happened yet. They're about, on paper, they're about $230 million apart in what's about $4.2 billion budget. And some of the differences haven't really been spelled out so that as people may be aware, there was a $6.5 million cut to Pioneer Homes that was included in the Senate budget, and the Senate senators have said that that was essentially a mistake, that it should have just been considered an unallocated cut where the Department of Health and Social Services could spread that around. So House members are actually saying this makes it difficult to talk about the operating budget because the Senate is essentially including cuts where they're basically saying that the cuts can be moved to other places. So it's hard to basically agree. House members are saying it's hard to agree on exactly whether you should go with the House version of the budget or the Senate version of the budget when the Senate version of the budget includes cuts that aren't really specific to anywhere in particular.
What did you hear this morning about their plan that would indicate the prospects for a longer term trying to get to a balanced budget?
Well, the House members say that that's what they've passed. It did take them essentially 89 days or 90 days to get there. They initially passed the income tax, what they're calling the school tax bill, on Saturday, and then it was basically pushed back another day, so the final vote was on Sunday. And so that took 90 days. They feel that what they've passed is the basis for a compromise. On the Senate side, they basically say that they've also passed a comprehensive plan. One of the big differences is that the Senate long-term plan includes essentially no spending increases for the next 10 years, which with inflation could amount to a 20%, roughly 20% cut in real inflation-adjusted dollars over the next 10 years. There's also – both sides haven't really included increases in the capital budget, although the House essentially passed more than enough to pay for the budget. So essentially, if everything that the House passed was put into law, then there would be some additional leftover for the capital budget. I would say that both sides say they want a comprehensive plan. Both sides say they've passed a comprehensive plan. But there are such significant differences between the two that there hasn't been any sign in the last couple weeks of either side taking steps toward the other. And so until we see that happen, it's hard to imagine a compromise.
Andrew, my last question. Thanks so much for laying this out for us. My last question is just about the mood and the tone at the Capitol right now. Are people tired, frustrated, despairing? You said that it looks like there's still a big divide between these two plans coming from both chambers. What is the mood there?
It's tough to put my finger on it because it's variable. I've seen legislators look very spirited one part of the day, and the same legislators look very dispirited later in the same day. And I think that as you're going to get into, I think with the guests, there are some really deep policy differences representing, I would say, different values, and I think both sides are frustrated that they don't see clear paths for they're basically enacting their vision for the state. And so I would say the mood varies between frustration. There's always hope. I think that people haven't given up on it. They very much hope to succeed in achieving a compromise that reflects their values. So there's a degree of hope. There's a large degree of frustration and a great deal of uncertainty. That's the predominant mood. The combination of hope, frustration, and uncertainty will be my answer.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Andrew, for being with us. That was Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman kind of setting the stage for our discussion today on the state's future. Thanks, Andrew.
You're welcome, Laurie. Thank you.
You can also join us if you're just tuning in. This is Talk of Alaska, and we are back to the budget today as lawmakers are on day 92 of the legislative session. You can join us if you've got ideas for fixing the budget crisis. Do you think an income tax is okay, or do you hate it? Should permanent fund checks be capped? Do you think there should be more cuts? Do you feel like your lawmakers are hearing what Alaskans want done? Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. That's statewide. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Now for our in-studio guests, again, ICERI economist Mohsin Gutabi is here, and past president of Commonwealth North and former OMB director Cheryl Frasca is also in the studio. First, I'd kind of like to get both of your reactions to Andrew's recounting of what's happening in Juneau right now, especially because there are these two plans out there, but we haven't heard about what the conference committees are, who's going to comprise them yet. if they're even moving in that direction. So, Cheryl, what do you have to say about what you just heard?
How depressing. No, actually, and I did spend, I was a 13 years, I was a legislative staffer and primarily for finance committee leaders. And so I share the pain of what it's like down there. And that was before there were even a limit on the length of session. I've got to think that the leaders on each both sides have thought all along that they're going to have to move to the middle. I just have to think that. Even though our political system does seem to be more polarized these days at local, state, and national levels, but still when the legislators are developing their legislation, negotiating in the future what the compromises will be, they know that there's compromises are going to have to take place. The challenge is they've done so much staking off in their corners what their positions are, and so that does complicate it. It's a challenge, and I hope that the governor is helping resolve this in a way towards, again, the middle to that compromise.
It does seem like compromise is the key word here. Mohsin Gutabi, what are your thoughts about what Andrew laid out and these two plans?
I think that Andrew did a good job of essentially laying out the ideas that are out there. I'll start with where I see agreement and where I think we've made progress, and it's the notion that we're to a large extent becoming a financial asset dependent state as opposed to a resource or a natural resource state. That's my interpretation of it, which is the agreement surrounding the usage of the permanent fund. Now, I think that moves us forward in the sense that, A, it takes a chunk of the deficit off the table, and it potentially narrows the band around which we're having the conversation. Not to say that that band is not relevant or is not difficult to close, because as Andrew alluded to, the two ideas around how to close that remaining $702 billion are very different. They represent different values. And I'm not sure how much of it is economics versus valuation of government or the degree to which we want to tie increases in population size to government services, the extent to which we value schools. So that's where it gets complicated in my mind. I think that not to say that the math is easy, but I think that the math is workable. It's once you combine the economics with this desire to either pay for government or figure out that magical right size of government, or to know whether or not the citizens are willing and able to help fund services. So, yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the state budget and looking at the different options that are on the table between the House and the Senate. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK statewide. In Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Cheryl, Commonwealth North passed a resolution, approved a resolution in February, urging lawmakers to use permanent fund earnings, but also maintain the dividend payments. It seems most lawmakers are coming around to the idea. For quite a long time, it was verboten to even mention using the permanent fund. Now it seems like there's some consensus around the fact that that's going to have to be part of the solution. The resolution says the long-term fix will require a number of fiscal tools. What are some of the other financial levers that you think need to be pulled in this regard?
Well, in February, we also released a report that was a follow-up to an operating budget-focused report, a spending report that we issued 2 years prior. And so in that, we made a number of recommendations regarding spending, or you know, big cost drivers. That's really what we focused on, education, Medicaid, and also the cost of state employees. And so we made a series of recommendations on the spending side. We did not get into some of the other revenue sources. And your mention of and using the permanent fund earnings, I mean, just think from a year ago, who would have thought that we'd be in a position, that state would be in a position where both houses have approved use of the permanent fund earnings. So I think the legislature deserves a lot of credit in getting to that point in agreeing. A lot of conditions were put on the House's version of that approval, but that's part of the compromise. But that's significant. So again, if you look at the cost of government, that was where we recommended some further, we made some recommendations and also some further studies.
Mm-hmm. And Mohsin, as we were hearing from Andrew and as is out there, the House wants an income tax, an overhaul of the oil tax system. They've also approved using permanent fund earnings and capping the dividend. Are they on the right track?
Well, as Andrew and Cheryl both alluded to, I think that they're to be commended for putting something out there. I think that anybody that's looked at this question carefully does come to the conclusion that it has to be a multifaceted approach, right? There is no silver bullet. There is no one source of money that's going to close the budget. And so are they on the right track? Potentially. When you look at the amount of money that an income tax raises, somewhere around $700 million or so, so that gets us much closer to, you know, that sustainable budget that you were referring to earlier. Now, of course, there are distributional questions, right? Who pays the tax? There are geographical implications. Who ends up, which communities end up bearing most of that burden? And so, like I said, in my mind, whether it's a sales tax, an income tax, whether it's a reduction in the PFD, when we did our analysis last year, realistically speaking, you can raise roughly similar amounts from any one of these approaches, but the burden does not fall on the same constituents in any on all of these options. And so, like I said, an income tax faces some resistance by some groups. Others see it as a really good tool, like I said, of tying government services to population size, right? And so my former colleague, Scott Goldsmith, had this Alaska disconnect statement, which meant that government services had no linkage whatsoever to the increase in population, right? And so we can sit here and say government services or government spending has increased substantially, and it has during times of riches, but it also has increased to a large extent as a result of the rise in population. And so a tax potentially links those two things together and allows you to monitor increases in government spending much better.
Well, we've got somebody on the line now that wants to talk about one element of this, a sales tax. Marty is in Anchorage. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I'm just curious why the sales tax proposal seems to have dropped out of the discussion. Up until fairly recently, there was a talk about a sales tax versus an income tax, but I haven't heard anything at all about a sales tax. It seems like lately all we discuss is an income tax. Can you contrast the differences between the two and why a personal income tax is better?
All right. Thanks for the question, Marty. I know that the sales tax idea is complicated, so complicated. If the state institutes a sales tax, Anchorage doesn't have one, but a lot of communities in rural Alaska already have local sales tax. And so if you've got a 5 or 7% sales tax and you put another 5% on that, yikes, that's a lot. There, I've heard discussion about, well, then maybe you exempt those communities, but it all seems to get very, very complicated. Who wants to take a shot at that?
I can start. To answer the question directly, I don't know why they're no longer talking about it. to compare and contrast, income tax is considerably more progressive than a sales tax. Sales tax is more regressive, meaning that the burden falls more on lower income people who end up who spend a larger portion of their incomes. To your point, so there are these relative burden questions, right? An income tax is paid largely by people that make a lot of money. A sales tax falls on middle and lower income people more so. And it also has those geographical implications that you've noted, right? And so we're working on something right now to try and understand how dependent are local government revenues on the state and how much money do they raise from a sales tax, and potentially how sensitive would those revenues be if there were to be a statewide sales tax. And so, and obviously, those communities would need time in order to adjust to how to collect the sales tax. That's not to say that it's better or worse. Again, in my mind, it's that decision on who do we want to shoulder some of this burden or pain going forward. Yeah.
Cheryl, have you heard, you know, Marty made an important point in that conversation about a sales tax. We haven't heard much about that lately. What are you hearing?
I haven't heard anything. And so that's saying a lot that there's no bubbling up. I got to assume it means that the Municipal League did a good job lobbying. Respectfully, I say that. But I mean, in other states, there are local county sales tax and a state sales tax. It isn't something phenomena that we couldn't, set in place a system to do it. Local governments currently collecting sales tax. That's their policy decision as opposed to a property tax or some other taxes. So when I worked at Anchorage, I marveled at all the visitors during the summer who were here, enjoying our state and our city and thinking, gosh darn, not one penny of their spend goes into our local coffers. So there's that piece of it that it's not just borne by Alaska residents. I realize income tax isn't either.
Right.
But it would be nice if there was some inflow. But no, it is interesting how it did just kind of drop off and why the income tax got all the traction.
Yeah, but Mohsin, has ICER looked at all at the expense of standing up either a state income tax system or a state sales tax system? As you mentioned, local municipalities, if there was a state sales tax, would have to figure out how to do that. Has there been any research about those two plans or ideas?
We specifically haven't looked at it. I know that the Tax Foundation has done some work on that. And it seems from the outside looking in, it seems like the sales tax would be more burdensome potentially to implement. But like Cheryl said, other places have done it. I mean, this is not a model that's unheard of. I don't think that the implementation burden is the culprit for it having died, right? And so, because it's also important to note that those are one-time costs, right? And we're talking about solutions for a sustainable budget looking, 40, 50 years into the future. So I have a hard time believing that the one-time burden is really what's resulted in its death.
Holding up.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Roger is in Palmer. Hi, Roger.
How are you doing today? I got a whole bunch of stuff.
All right. Let's get started.
Per diem that they're supposed to be getting while they're in session. Once it goes past 90 days, that per diem should stop.
All right, there's idea one.
South Dakota do is that keeps their feet close to their bottom,
Okay.
And another thing, personal shipping of stuff back and forth to Juneau, it should not include snow machines, four-wheelers. It's only the personal clothing and items they need to live on, because they're making a fortune off the state this way. Tenure of people like the president of UAA and UAF should be more than 5 years. It should be 15 years. They go in there and make this huge salary, and then they get out and draw that huge retirement, and it's just sucking us dry. We got, and we need to drain the swamp. There's a lot of men there that are incompetent, and they don't need to be there. They're just drawing that per diem. The pipeline, I think it's a lost cause, because the time they get it in, they'll never make money off from it because of the price of gas versus the cost of operating and putting in that pipeline.
Well,
so they need to consider things like that before they do anything, because somebody's putting money in their pocket. South Dakota has is a little bit larger population than Alaska, 800,000 something. Alaska got 700,000 something, and the disparity in the budgets. South Dakota's got it 7 point something billion. Alaska's got 13 billion in 2016. Who's getting money in their pocket? It's sure not going where it's supposed to.
Well, thank you, Roger, so much for laying out your thoughts on this. It's always interesting to hear these perspectives and how people, and it kind of indicates why the legislature has a tough job, because people have such wide-ranging ideas and beliefs in how we get there. And so it's always great to hear from Alaskans. We're going to go to Juneau now. Thanks so much, Roger and Palmer. Dan is in Juneau. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm kind of curious of what the cost and effect would be of this Senate budget of no increase for 10 years. You hear them talking about, well, with just a little bit increase in the price of oil, the budget balances, but if they're expecting no increase in the budget, meaning no raises for our state union workers and so on, over the course of 10 years, that's not very realistic. Especially when you figure the price of oil goes up, why then the price of gasoline goes up, the price of shipping goes up, and so on.
So in effect, flat funding is essentially a cut.
Correct. And it's not very realistic to my way of thinking. We're supposed to have intelligent people running the state, and you just kind of wonder about their voodoo economic plan.
Do you have ideas, Dan, about what you'd like to see happen?
Well, I'm one of the Alaskans old enough to have paid a state income tax, and it didn't hurt that bad. And it's more equitable than a sales tax. You know, you go to Anchorage, us folks that live outside of Anchorage, and you buy something and you don't pay any sales tax, you just feel like you're getting away for free, you know. And if we put on a state sales tax, it's going to hurt the other municipalities that survive on the local sales tax.
Right.
You know, even if the state sales tax was only 5% and the local sales tax, well, Ketchikan, they've got a city tax and a borough tax, and then you add a state tax on top of that, and you're going to wind up well over 10%, I think.
Potentially, yes. In some places, that could certainly happen.
Yes. You know, some states, they have a sales tax, but they don't tax essential things like food. But if we don't do that, you're not going to get a lot of revenue. So how do you balance that? And that's why, like I say, you know, 40-some years ago, we were paying a state income tax. And, you know, even though I've paid up to, you know, $25,000 in federal sales or income tax, 7 or 8% of that, you know, if you're in a higher tax bracket, you can afford to fund things a little bit more than somebody in a lower bracket. And it's the folks that are more well-to-do that use more services, such as airports, highways, and so on, whereas, you know, if you get in the lower wage earners, they can't even afford a vehicle.
Well, thanks, Dan. I appreciate your comments and your thoughts on this. We're going to have to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll continue our conversation about which direction to go fiscally for the future of the state of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our last caller was talking about paying an income tax. And the other day, Representative Dan Sadler said of the income tax, he was not happy about the proposal. And he said, let's call this for what it is. It is income redistribution. It's taking from the haves and giving to the have-nots. Cheryl, what are your thoughts about this comment?
Well, that is what an income tax does. I mean, it does bring those that can afford to pay more, as our last caller just was mentioning, pay more, and it is going into the distribution of services. And so those services tend to be to lower income, whether it's Medicaid or other types of social services that the state does provide. And again, that gets to the earlier discussion about values. And that really is a value discussion, and we don't take time to really talk about that. And one of our Commonwealth North recommendations was to have a true citizen engagement process by which you bring Alaskans together, provide them with some information, so it's factual, not opinions, and you talk about the trade-offs that are involved in making these kinds of choices. And I think even though if we get over a hurdle on the earnings of the permanent fund, this is going to continue to be a butting up of heads on the values that legislators are choosing and citizens are opining on. So I think that's important to have that discussion.
And, you know, the perspective that you just gave, similar to Representative Sadler's, is that that's one way of seeing an income tax, is that it's taking from the higher earners to help support services for people who don't make a lot of money. But also it's in support of roads and schools and law enforcement. Mohsin, do you want to weigh in on this concept of how, from this perspective, an income tax is an uneven burden? What are your thoughts about that?
From a pure economic standpoint, and let's just go to the federal level, for example, the federal tax code is littered with redistributive policies in both directions, right? And so we have a capital gains tax, for example, that redistributes money towards the upper income. We have a mortgage interest deduction that does the same thing, but then an income tax redistributes it, arguably, from higher income to lower income, right? And so the reality is that it's very, very hard to structure a tax that affects everybody equally unless you come up with some sort of flat rate or something along those lines. And even then, you can make an argument that it's redistributive in one way or another. I think that the conversation, at least the way from which we've approached it, is what are we trying to achieve? Are we trying to close the budget gap? Are we trying to find a sustainable solution? Or are we trying to figure out who bears the burden, right? And two to three very different questions, and you're going to get very different solutions depending on what you're trying to do, right? And so are we trying to find a solution that is sustainable, that closes the budget in order for us to have good schools and good roads and good government services? Or are we trying to mitigate pain on a subset of Alaskans? And to what extent are we worried about this question of redistribution? It seems like there are some people that are really worried about it. And others say, well, you know what? The reality is that we have one of the most even distributions of income in the country, to a large extent, thanks to the permanent fund.
Right.
Thanks to the fact that blue-collar occupations in Alaska pay a very high premium, and therefore there isn't that white-collar, blue-collar difference that you find in other places. And so we're a unique state in a way. And so, it's difficult depending on the perspective from which you approach the question. And in my mind, the bigger question of closing the budget gap matters, but this question of who ends up bearing the burden is also worth mentioning and gets back to what Cheryl said. It's a question of values.
Let's go to the phones again. Doug is in Copper Center and has another tax idea. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, I personally, you know, we could discuss income tax versus other tax and where we're spending our money. It's all been rehashed. I mean, there's lots of problems in this state. But I have been imploring all legislators for an emergency 2% payroll tax and a 2% resource tax. So that captures fishing industry, mining, petroleum, 2% off the top. You never see it. You don't need the IRS. It's not based on regressive or progressive taxes. It's a flat rate, 2% emergency for 2 years, and that will give these legislators and the leadership in this state, if we have any, time to come up with a fair, equitable way of taxing us. But 2% off the top is when you never see it. Yeah, it affects the poor more than the rich. But not really. It affects everybody the same. Then we all have blood in the game. Anyway, thank you for this discussion.
All right. Thank you, Doug, for the call. Cheryl, you're a former OMB director. What are your thoughts about an emergency tax, 2%, as Doug proposed? I like these creative ideas. It's fun to hear the calls come in.
Sure. Well, but it seems like the translates into a 2% increase in the cost of services. I mean, so somebody's going to pay it, and it's going to trickle down. And so you're still going to have less money in your family's budget, ultimately. So there's no free lunch, as it's often been said. So, but, you know, creative thinking. And I think there is skepticism about if anything is ever really temporary. There's some concern about that piece of it, but, you know, appreciate the thoughts.
Yeah. Mohsin, any thoughts?
Really interesting and creative idea. I think that the challenge is that it potentially prolongs this uncertainty that we've been experiencing. The business community has been very vocal about the negative consequences of uncertainty, the fact that businesses are sitting in the sidelines and willing to hire and willing to commit to long-term projects because they don't have confidence in what's to come. Similarly, people with outside options, highly educated individuals who are unsure about the prospects of their jobs and whether or not the legislature is going to get it right, are looking outside. And so there is a cost to prolonging this process. And, you know, whether this emergency tax sends the right signal, right? And so a lot of this is about signaling to households, to businesses as to how secure should they be? Should they be making long-term plans? Because that, again, ends up affecting how often do I eat out? Do I buy a car? Does a business hire that part-time worker? And clearly, economic activity has already been weak. And so I always hesitate whenever there is something proposed that has the potential of exacerbating an already weak economy by sending the wrong message. But it's a really interesting idea.
I think it is an interesting idea. All right. Let's stay with the phones for a little bit here. We have a lot of interested Alaskans in this discussion. Alexander is in Juneau. Hi, Alexander.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Your panel has congratulated the legislature for coming to consensus on using the permanent fund earnings. And frankly, I'd like to express a different point of view. To me, that's an expression of failure in this whole process, really. The fact that we're going to go after permanent fund earnings should be an outrage to Alaskans. There's enough money that came through Prudhoe Bay over the course of its history, to create 8 permanent funds, but we only created 1, and it was dedicated to the people. Governor Jay Hammond announced at the creation of the dividend program that the dividends and the earnings of the fund belong to the people, not the government. He was very explicit about that. But here we are now. The solution to the problem, apparently, is to take the people's money to solve this problem. I think one of the outrages is there couldn't be a more regressive choice in how to solve this fiscal crisis than using permanent fund dividends. It's going to have an enormous impact on the economy, for one, and also it is going to take the same amount of money from the very richest Alaskan as it takes from the very elderly, the poor, the disabled, and crazily, it takes money from children. Children are the legal recipients of those dividends, and now we're going to be taking a share of their money to help solve this fiscal crisis. I don't think any other state looks to children to help pay the cost of government. So as far as regressive measures, this one couldn't be more regressive.
And what are your thoughts about what does need to happen?
Okay. You know, I can understand why the legislature is targeting this large pool of money, because it's the only large pool of money around. However, you know, we're in a crisis. I think by definition, a crisis isn't a permanent condition. You're eventually going to come out of this crisis. You know, one possibility is that the price of oil will come back up. Other possibilities are that we will find ways of right-sizing our budget. But the solutions, in my mind, are that we do need broad-based taxes. We do need an income tax. We also, I think, should have a sales tax, because we have more than a million people coming into the state every year as visitors. They put burdens on government, and I think they should participate in helping us pay these costs. And one way to do that is with a sales tax. The other thing about the income tax is only half of Americans pay a federal income tax, so therefore they won't pay any income tax for the state of Alaska.
Right.
So in order to spread the burden around, I think we need to have multiple taxing mechanisms.
All right.
But again, I do want to say here's one thing that I do want to leave with you, and that is that I think all Alaskans should be talking to their legislators and saying, look, get us through this crisis. But then figure out a way of ratcheting back the earnings of the permanent fund back to its rightful owners, the people. And I think that's possible. I think it is possible in 5 or 10 years to begin to restore the permanent fund dividend program back to the people where it belongs.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alexander. We got to go. We got calls on every line and 2 guests in the studio. Thanks for the call. So reactions to what Alexander just said, and I've heard this from other Alaskans, let's get through this crisis and then things will be better. Maybe oil prices will come back. Maybe, you know, there's been some new finds on the North Slope, so here's the shiny thing over here. But the seesaw effect that we see based on the price of oil, it seems like if we're ever really going to have fiscal stability, we've got to come up with a different way of stabilizing state finances beyond just fixation on what is today's per barrel price of oil. So, Mohsin, what are your thoughts about, you know, he listed a lot of things, taxes, but leave the permanent fund alone. Is that possible?
In the current state of things, it's very hard to envision a solution that's sustainable going forward without the usage of the permanent fund. Now, that's not to say, so there are 2 conversations. There's the dividend, and then there is the usage of the permanent fund earnings in order to fund a portion of government, right? And so,
right.
And you know, he mentioned that we've spent 5 or 6 times the size of the permanent fund, and that's fair. But one of the things that's worth being reminded of is a lot of that spending that has occurred is responsible for much of the development that we've experienced over the last 50 years. What I mean by that is by investing in roads, by investing in people, That has reduced the cost of entry for a lot of firms, right? We have a lot of national retailers. We have a lot of big players that wouldn't have come had it not been for early investments. It's tough to tease out exactly the benefits of that government spending because we don't see it. We just see the retailer come in, but that retailer would not have come in had it not been for all of the things that had happened beforehand. And so that's one way of slicing it. I don't disagree with the premise that permanent fund dividends help families. They're important. They help children. They potentially are a good source of savings for colleges. But, you know, looking at it slightly differently, I think that we're faced with, he refers to the crisis as temporary, but the reality is that oil production has been declining since 88.
Right.
We were saved by a couple of windows of really high oil prices. You mentioned the fines. There is a tremendous amount of uncertainty surrounding said fines. We don't know what's going to happen to oil prices. Do you structure a solution that reduces volatility, allows you to plan for the future, signals very strongly to future investors, to businesses, to individuals, to bond raters that we know what we're doing, we've got our house in order, or do you tie your future to this extremely...
To the price of oil.
I'm not dismissing the concern, and I think it's valid, but I see it as a rainy day fund. It's raining.
It is definitely raining right now. Yeah. Cheryl, your thoughts on this. People feel very strongly about this, and the history of why the fund was put into place is of note.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree with everything that Mohsin said in terms of the signal it sends. Actually, you know, I remember the legislative hearings when the dividend was created. My takeaway from it was to help people pay for the higher cost of living in Alaska. And whether it takes $1,000 to do that or $2,000 to do it, I don't know. We just have we're at that fork in the road. And so the legislature is choosing a path as opposed to just punting until the next session or the next 2 years from now. So I think that's significant, and it's difficult for him. That's where we are today.
Do you think that if, and we're going to have to take another quick break here in a moment and then hopefully get a few more calls on because we've got lots of them stacked up. Do you think that, as he mentioned, maybe it's the crisis might not be temporary, but maybe the use of the permanent fund could be a temporary situation to get us to a place where there is some range of new taxes in place, maybe some restructuring of other taxes. Is that a way to fiscal solvency? Could we then say, okay, take the heat off the permanent fund now and just go forward with new sources of revenue? Cheryl, what's your thoughts on that?
I think that's part of what the Senate's approach was. In fact, with its, quote, spending limit, and also that the earnings of the permanent fund would be reduced based on other revenues. So it's a recognition that kind of like triggers, if this, then that. And so I think the legislators seem to be sensitive to the need to be able to shift course a little, but still find that stability.
All right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, more talk about the budget as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Their online, evening, and campus-based courses make education accessible and will fit into any busy schedule. Be motivated by a devoted faculty and creative, independent-minded students. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. Moving life ahead with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go back to the phones again and talk with Dave in Petersburg. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about value, the value of the dollar, value of education, and nobody can disagree with the value of those things, of course. One of the things I'm not hearing is the value of being the last frontier. You know, personally, I sold out of a business, had a little nest egg, bought a little chunk of property, and I'm in Alaska with a very small income on purpose, right? So that I can be outside of that box. Purely a personal choice, you know. And an income tax, a state income tax, would be another hurdle towards that lifestyle, I think. And if, without penalizing the rich for being rich, which seems ridiculous to me, the only other way to solve the, you know, the problem is to have user fees, right? Like a sales tax. You choose to spend money, you choose to pay for the system. This is the last place in the United States where you can come and actually go to the woods for a relatively small amount of money and just kind of carve out your existence and live outside of all the madness. Hmm. And I don't hear anybody talking about just the straight value of that. And that the more layers of bureaucracy we lay on it, the more difficult it becomes to have that. And it's unique. It's a unique Alaskan thing. You know, I might get arguments from the people in Wyoming or something, but the point still remains is this is the place you come to, you know, and it's the last place.
All right.
Here in the United States.
Well, that, you know, it's hard. I think it's hard to quantify.
You can't put a, like a monetary, but it still deserves to be a part of the conversation because we're doing away with that lifestyle piece by piece. And that's all I got, really. I mean, I don't know how to solve the fiscal crisis. I just want some value added to my lifestyle, man.
Well, yeah. Thanks for the call, Dave, and good luck with that life that you've mapped out for yourself. It sounds pretty satisfying. You know, a lot of people have talked about this idea of taxes, and we have a lot of calls on the line and emails about sales tax and. There's been several questions by email about, so what do we collect from people that come in, the tourists? And you were mentioning, boy, all those visitors come. Would a seasonal sales tax help really in a comprehensive way, or would it be more symbolic than actually getting us a big chunk of the way there? Has that been looked at, Musin?
Yeah, I mean, you can raise money from non-residents. You can either try to target non-residents or structure a tax that basically changes during the summer or increase it for certain goods that you know are consumed specifically by non-residents. But the reality is, and I don't know who mentioned this earlier, the income tax also does that to a certain extent because 20% of workers are non-residents. And so we would be collecting some of that. And in both cases, the federal government would be paying for a bit of this tax because you can, if you itemize, you can deduct the state tax, whether it be sales or income tax, from your federal taxes. And so, yes, should a significant portion of the revenues be targeted to non-residents if possible? Absolutely. Is it easy to do? Probably not. Does a sales tax do it better than income tax? Maybe. But again, it's this question of how much of a footprint are we actually generating from tourists? And does a sales tax just targeting tourists solve the problem? No. I mean, we can't raise enough money to solve the whole gap by just going after the...
So it would have to be part of a suite of other things.
Yeah, and it has to be part of a suite of other things. And I mean, the last two calls that we've received are really interesting because they show the trade-offs very clearly. We had one person that said the permanent fund should be off limits, and the other one said that taxes should be off limit, right? And those are very real trade-offs, right? That they go head-to-head. The more revenues outside of the permanent fund we establish, the less burden we put on the permanent fund and therefore the permanent fund dividend. Mm-hmm. The fewer taxes, less freedom, the more burden we put on the permanent fund and its future growth. And
therein lies the problem.
Therein lies the problem.
Trying to find some consensus.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones once again here. David is in Anchorage. Hi, David.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I read in the paper the comment that someone referred to about taking from the haves for the have-nots on taxes. I would like to point out, please, that when we eliminate the permanent fund or those payments or reduce them, we're taking a lot from the have-nots to give to the haves. And when we're putting $1,000 or $2,000 head tax on every child, every woman, everybody in the state, and saying that people like one of the people who are heading up one of the groups that are opposing the sales tax, the income tax, is making $3 million a year. If that person has to give up a permanent fund of $8,000, it's infinitesimal. And yet, if you live in Mountain View, or if you live in one of the villages, and there are four of you, and you give up $8,000, that's a third or more of your total income. You know, we keep throwing around a lot of numbers, and we forget that those numbers are standing in front of people, and we need to look at those people. Someone mentioned invest in the people, and yet here we're cutting UAA, which is one of our biggest investments in people in the state.
All right. Sure. Well, thanks, David. We're going to have to go. We've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to give our guests thanks so much for your thoughts. It's clear you feel very strongly about this. Sorry to all the callers that we're not going to get to today. This could have been a two-hour program. Cheryl, your final thoughts in our last couple of minutes here about what you'd like to see happen this week.
Well, first, I think the perspectives that the callers shared is a glimpse into what must be going on in the legislature. And how would you get 11 and 21 members of the two bodies to agree? And I think this shows the values that each of the callers had and the challenge that faces the legislators in coming to agreement. What I'd like to see happen this week is for them to reach compromise, recognizing that it's not going to be done in one day or one week, that it may be, in fact, an incremental process, but I still think use of the permanent fund as investment earnings is significant in terms of providing that longer-term stability.
So moving in that direction.
Absolutely.
Lucene?
Yeah, not what? Terribly dissimilar. I think that... If there is a way to get back to this signaling to residents and businesses alike that we are thinking not just about a short-term fix, but about a sustainable budget, that doesn't mean solving everything this year, but it does mean sending a strong message that we're committed to, for example, again, recognizing that we've become a financial asset dependent state, and that there will be some form of a tax, and that we will find these other revenues in order to have a budget that's sustainable going forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Sorry to all the callers that we did not get to. It's clear that Alaskans feel very strongly on multiple sides of this issue. Thanks so much to my guests today. Musin Gutabi is with the Institute of Social and Economic Research at UAA, ICER, and Cheryl Frasca, who is with Commonwealth North, is a past president there and is also a former OMB director for both state and the municipality of Anchorage. Thanks to Andrew Kitchenman for joining us as well, and thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week with a discussion on sustainable fisheries on Talk of Alaska. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.